Welcome to the ColbyCast, episode 201. Thank you for joining us. After a brief intermission, Dr. Carl Hassler, Mrs. Olivia Konufke, and Jordan returned to join Bonnie and I for the second movement of our music discussion. Our conversation turns to exploring classical music, being moved by it, and how it can stretch our souls. Hopefully our conversation can help to inspire you to explore music and discover the soundtrack for your life. We hope that you'll enjoy the show.
Hi there, I'm Bonnie, Colby homeschooling mom of four lads and lasses, liturgical musician, popcorn, and podcast fanatic.
And this is Stephen, homeschooling father of five and chief homeschooling officer for Colby Academy.
And I'm Jordan. As a product of homeschooling, I'm proud to teach Greek and Latin for Colby Online and serve as the alumni and public relations director.
All right, so Jordan and Stephen, we have brought back Dr. Carl Hassler and Mrs. Olivia Konufke for what I am thinking of as the second movement in what I hope will be a multi-movement work in the form of a conversation about music. Glad you guys are back to hopefully pick up where we left off in our conversation that we began in, I guess that would be the first movement, episode 188 of our conversation. I'm not quite sure what form this whole work is going to take. We'll just let it be what it will be. So when we finished that conversation, we were hoping to pick up starting with how to introduce people to classical music. As a starting point, Olivia, if you could tell us how the rest of your music history course went, and if there were students for whom that subject was entirely new, or how you kind of broached that. How did that go?
Yeah, so we just finished our inaugural semester of the music history course, and it was a huge success. The students all did really well. I was really impressed with their grasp of music history by the end of the semester. And yes, I actually was thinking about this when I was thinking about preparing for this podcast, is I had at least three or four of my students reach out to me in some way and say, you know, Mrs. Konufke, I never really thought I liked classical music, or I never really thought about classical music until your class. And now I think, I've learned so much and I notice classical music now, or, I'm interested in it now. And that just was so heartwarming to hear. And so we did have really some students who came into the class doing it because they wanted to fulfill, a certain class credit. And then they found, oh my goodness, this whole other side to history and this whole other side to, our world that they probably hadn't really dipped their toes into before. So that was really gratifying as a teacher to hear that and to see how some students really had that experience of going from never really having touched classical music to finding it really interesting.
That is great to hear. For those who spoke up, did they mention any particular era or a work maybe they heard somewhere in the wild, so to speak, and they're like, oh, that brought that to their attention?
Well, some of them, what one student said is he thought that classical music was just kind of boring in general. And then as we learned about composers and their lives, and then also with the different time periods, he said there was so much excitement, and there was, these different composers with such characters, and they lived such interesting and different lives, and the obstacles they overcame, and, learning about their personal lives and then their music and how their music maybe reflected their personal life or what was going on in the world at the time. That really, I think, brought classical music to life for this one in particular, this student in particular, who at first had thought, it's kind of just all boring and not really my thing. But somehow hearing about the, intricacies and the stories behind a lot of the music made him more compelled to listen to the music and like it more.
That's great. Isn't that interesting how there's this sort of general attitude, like classical music is all one genre, and it's so actually so varied that if you give it a chance, you find all kinds of, right. it's not, anyway.
Yeah. And I also think, you can kind of be like, oh, classical music, that's what my mom listens to, or my dad listens, that's what the old people listen to. This student in particular, he was like, wow, some of these, composers were really like, they got in trouble for what they were writing at the time, or they were, considered like bad boys of the time because they were breaking these rules, and you know their use of harmony and melody was totally out there. And you know Tchaikovsky was accused of not being Russian enough with his music, and the Russian people like turned on him. You know all these things that you wouldn't really know about, and it does. It makes it more compelling. It makes it more exciting. It's you know brings it to life. And I think this student was like, oh yeah, these composers are anything but boring. They had pretty exciting lives, most of them.
Do you find it takes your students who are new to the topic, new to listen, like so for like the listening dimension of the course, does it take them some time to adjust to that sort of attentiveness to listening to the various selections that are assigned, or much, probably very similar to the reading that is assigned in much of our Colby curriculum? It takes kind of some building up. It takes a certainly a level of attention that a lot of music that's out there does not demand of us. So how did you hear much feedback on that?
What I noticed is I just saw in class, you know, we would start class with listening, some kind of listening, and I wouldn't tell them the name or the composer or the name of the piece, and they would just listen. I would ask them to put in, you know, sometimes it was a phrase, sometimes it was one word response. And at first, you know, some students were a little bit timid and what they said, and you know, kind of, you know, didn't want to disagree with other people if one person said they, you know, thought the piece was really happy and joyous. The other person didn't want to say, oh, I thought it was melancholy or something like that. And then I found as the class went on, people kind of found like, no, I can say what I actually like, my interpretation of this piece, I can share it too. And it might be different. And it might, you know, not be what you think. Or maybe I don't like this piece. And, you know, towards the end, we were getting into some of the early modern composers, and some the students were like, I do not like Stravinsky at all. And I was like, that's okay. You don't have to like Stravinsky. That we can still learn about him and he cannot be your style. That is okay. So I did find that, you know, as I kind of coaxed it out of them, they would the students who hadn't had as much experience started to share their thoughts a little more freely with what they were listening to.
That's great. Dr. Hausler, when you make your recommendations that I referred to in the previous recording, some of them you make are from the classical genres. The one that sticks out to me right now is Faure's PAA. So I'm not sure why that one is coming to mind, but you make a vast array of recommendations. Anyhow, that one falls within sort of this conversation. What sort of responses do you get from students for whom that and other more classical pieces, as opposed to some of the, I guess, what might be considered more folkish or later works?
Well, when I get a response,
Okay.
it's almost always positive. A surprising number of students here at Colby know classical music and know it probably better than I do, which may not be saying much, but okay, but they do. And so a lot of times when I've recommended something that's falls in the so-called classical genre, I'll have two or three kids in every class go, "Oh yeah, I love this piece. I love that. Oh, I love that variation, or I love that interpretation, or which one is that?" You know, they'll know that there are a variety of them. So I always get positive. Now I'm thinking, I had a student or two, oh, a couple years back in one of my classes who was an anti-classical person. And I would get over the course of the year, I would get this sort of begrudging, "Yeah, it's not bad. I kind of like that one." So it's, I think a lot of times, particularly with the popular music scene, whatever that constitutes now, you know, you're listening to something that goes for 3.5 minutes, and that's all you have to even think about, and then you're on to the next one. And in a large amount of classical music, you know, 3 minutes may get you one theme in the music that now is going to get developed over the course of the next 10 minutes or so until you get to the end of the piece that's, you know, 30 minutes long. And so it takes, like you said about reading here in our curriculum, It takes building up your stamina, as it were, building up your attention, building up your ability to sit and hear something over a course of 10, 15, 20 minutes or so before you can begin to start understanding what it is that you've just listened to. And so I think some of the kids that I've introduced things to, they didn't have the attention span, and it took them a while, perhaps, for them to develop that attention span. And so, having said that, most of the commentary that I get from kids is that they enjoy what I share, even when it's the more popular or more contemporary kinds of music that I will recommend to them. So that's what I get.
It's interesting thinking about the attention span and like having to be introduced into this other world, and it can almost be shocking, even though it's a world that is our inheritance. I was thinking about this. I had forgotten this podcast episode was coming up, but I drove 6 hours to take my son to play hockey in Maine, and we were. When I thought he fell asleep, I left it on the classical station, but we just jump into like the middle of some piece, a long piece that they were playing, and he loved it. He didn't want me to switch it at the end. He was like, wow, like he was imagining it like made him picture a whole story in his mind or something. He's 8 years old, but he's thinking, and it did something laying there relaxing. We were alone, and just hearing this, taking it all in, and it got me thinking, what we do a lot is point people to the great books, to the great works, and that includes music, and there is the equivalent in literature as well. So I have these two books sitting here, the listeners can't see, but this one is a very sophisticated work that takes forever, especially if you're not a native German speaker, but it introduces you into this whole tradition of it's a study on some on things that developed in the Middle Ages and came down to us, and this is an entry point into it, and you have to be really malleable to stick with a book like this. This book is in German, it's very technical. And it's an important work, but it would take, you'd have to learn German before you can even read it. And then once you're able to read it, even then it's hard and it takes time to get through it. So that's a book that I have on my shelf, and I've got a lot of those like that. And I bought another book that I think is relevant to this conversation. I bought it as a joke book because my daughters hate this particular artist, so I bought it for them for Christmas. It's this little book that is for those who are just listening, this is a Taylor Swift, a little golden book, takes like you were saying about pop music. It's 3.5 minutes. That's how long you can read this book, and I guess you learn something about Taylor Swift or whatever. But we call both of those literature, I guess, loosely. And I don't know if we notice that as much with music. Maybe some of the pop music is the equivalent of a little book like that.
That's funny.
Yeah, there's so many different ways my mind was going already as we're talking here, but yeah, that I did not grow up with any classical music and started to kind of sample it maybe a little bit when I was in high school, and I certainly that would be like trying to go from the Taylor Swift book you just picked up to reading the Iliad, so I at first it was like, oh, this is a there's pleasant sounds that I can play in the background almost was the initial thing. And when I started spending time with my wife, who grew up with classical music all around her, she'd be like, how can you just play this in the background? I mean, I have to, I it draws my attention. I need to focus on it. And it wasn't until just recently that that actually started, when I'm working on a spreadsheet or whatever, and I said, oh, I'm going to put on some classical music. And it's like, I'm paying attention to the music, not on what I'm working on now. Whereas, so then I can put on my normal music, the more folk, as we say, but rock music for primarily is what I was listening to, and that can now for me can go on in the background, and it's drowning out the other noises, and I can just focus in. But I think that's a kind of a critical that maturity, I guess, of being able to focus and being able to hold things in your mind, seems like that's key, I guess. But it also doesn't surprise me that Jordan's son can do that, because I've heard his family all sings and harmonizes, so they clearly can. They have that ability to hold things in their mind and hear, put things together, which is not something I had. So that's really interesting.
I find that kind of interesting too, and I suspect Olivia can speak more to this, but I can't very often do any kind of work with music on. Doesn't matter what kind of music it is, because I will immediately just start listening to the lines in the music, and then I can't really, you know, do anything. I can't grade papers with music playing. I wish I could. It would drown out some of the noise of the papers, but I can't do that. And unless I'm doing something really just sort of mundane, I can't listen to music and do other things, because I will listen to what's going on in the music, and it will distract me, and I can't read and listen to music. I can't do any of that kind of stuff. So that's very interesting. It's very interesting you would say that.
I'm the same way in that I can't listen to non-classical music for sure. If I'm trying to do something, it's just too distracting to me. But I can't even listen. Words are really the turning point. Like, I can't listen to opera either, even though I don't speak German or Italian or whatever language. Something about the words. Since I'm a cellist, I definitely cannot listen to any cello piece when I'm, because I'll just be like, oh, that's how they, because a lot of the pieces I'll either know or I'll want to know, and I'll just get completely derailed in that direction. But I thought it was interesting something that Mr. Hayden was saying about how, you know, I don't want to bash on other types of music besides classical music. I'm a classical musician that a lot, like, I do love other types of music too. I'm not one of those. I'm not a hater on other types of music. You know, I have things that I like about certain genres and not others, but you know, with something like folk music or rock music, you know, there's definitely like a place, in my opinion, there is a place for that type of music, and there's a place for classical music. But I was thinking about what we were talking about with, you know, attention span, and how classical music really challenges you to listen in a different way. And it cannot be as catchy sometimes as your favorite pop song, right? Or your favorite refrain from, you know, whatever, something that's a little, you know, that's outside the genre of classical music, especially when it comes to words. If you think about like your typical pop song, you know, it's a series of just a certain amount of chords, and then you have your, you know, your refrain, and it's a catchy refrain. And in a way, it's like eating like a bag of chips. Like, it's really just easy to keep eating those chips, because it's easy, right? It's easy to listen to. But I think that sometimes people who think that they don't like classical music, it might be because they haven't had the chance to sit with it longer, and it's something that may take you longer to enjoy and feel comfortable with. And also, I mean, in my opinion, there's the greatest variety within classical music of any genre. You know, I mean, that's one thing that my students really, you know, gave me this feedback this semester, is they're like, wow, there's, you know, a Baroque piece is so different from a Romantic era piece. Like, you know, a Bach Prelude and Fugue sounds completely different than, you know, a Wagner opera, than a Chopin Nocturne. And I think that was one thing that opened their eyes, is they thought, oh, I really thought classical music was only Bach. Or I really thought classical music was only, you know, violin. That's all I, like, that's, that was the only instrument I really knew. And then you realize, oh, no, there's so much variety within classical music. And I think if someone said to me, I don't like classical music, I'd say, well, we maybe haven't found your particular favorite within classical music, but I would challenge you that you probably can find something you like within the genre, because there is such a variety, but it also may take you sitting with it a little bit before you kind of are able to maybe uncover your, you know, that you like it. where in a way the yeah like the pop song might be easier to just be like, oh yeah, that's catchy, I like it, I can sing that to myself, it's fun, you know, makes me want to like bop my head or whatever. But yeah, there is that kind of difference with classic music from other genres.
We've had some conversations. Well, I mean, clearly through Colby here, we're getting we as times have changed, there's different eras, and music in particular is reflecting music has sur that survives. It reflects the soul of the people of the time, and I just think so much about how different our time is today than these times where much of the classical music was being produced, at least. You know, when you think about our modern day, as we have a lack of silence for one, you know, there's constant distraction and noise. We are a working culture, you know, so we don't there isn't this sense of sort of leisure and things. And it was actually a well, when you look at our clothes, when you look at our buildings, it's clear that we are a working people. We all wear working clothes. There's no we nobody's walking around in robes, really, for the most part, or things like that. You know, you look at our architecture, it's functional or ugly, one of the two. You know, it's we're
Both.
not building both. Yes, and no craftsmen. We're not building cathedrals that take 40 years to build. Even if it looks like some of the old cathedrals, it takes a year or two with all sorts of modern techniques and facades. So just the character of people today, I mean, the music that we listen to fits that, right? It's short. It's getting trying to get your attention. It's doing these things, which is good because that's what our souls are like for the most part. But it's nice to be able to go back and see what the beauty, the just like looking at great art or great architecture of the past, to see the beauty in it and be able to stretch your soul so that maybe you go beyond, you know, what we're in right now too, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of classical. I think one of the things that drew me to classical music, among other things, was it allowed you to slow down and be more contemplative about things. And when I started getting into more popular music, rock music, I looked for things that were elongated, longer pieces of music. And fortunately, I grew up in the prog rock moment in the 70s, where there were bands that obviously many of the musicians in these bands had been cl classically trained, and they were trying to adapt their classical training to this longer kind of way of writing music. It was popular for about 4 or 5 years until the industry realized, well, we can't sell that as quickly as we can the 3 or 4 minute songs. And that began to die by the early 80s. And I watched this because I was working in the music industry or the record industry, not the music industry, right? Well, it's sort of the music industry, the record industry, retail side of things. And I watched how those attempts were falling away and not selling because they weren't being promoted because they couldn't sell them as quick, you know, all the radio stuff. So that's what I got interested in, along with playing classical music as I was growing up. And I wanted to find those things that allowed me not to have to continually be running to the next thing. How do you slow down?
I know, Mr. Hayden, one thing you wanted to talk about was, you know, disordered versus ordered music. And I hope it's okay that I bring that in here because I was thinking about, well, my husband, he grew up not having a whole lot of exposure to classical music. He didn't play any instruments. And when he was in high school, he listened to the radio a ton. And he talks about that at one point he got really serious about his studies. He was preparing for college and he kind of, you know, just wanted to kind of train his mind a little bit better. And he stopped listening to the radio as much and he really started listening to pretty much only classical music and Gregorian chant. And he's told me many times how his ability to read for longer periods was also enhanced at that time. So he could just, he said before, you know, I'd read a couple pages, I'd be like, okay, that's enough. Like, I just got to go do something else, you know? And he could sit there and he's like, all of a sudden I could just sit and my focus was so good. And he said, I really do think it was, you know, in line with the fact that I was now listening to a lot more classical music where it is like Dr. House was saying, you know, you're not constantly flipping to the next song. And you know, maybe there's a place for that, for music where it is more, you know, maybe in your brain functions a little bit faster and it's more kind of fast paced music. You know, maybe you're getting ready for your basketball game or something. You may not want to put on a classical piece at that point, and you might need something a little bit more pop to it at that time. But I do think when it comes to like the ordering of our soul, there is, you physically feel a reaction when you listen to music, right? Like we physically feel it in our body when we, a certain kind of, whether you like the song or not, you feel a certain way. If something has a heavy beat, a fast beat versus a slow beat, you know, obviously lyrics would play into that too. And that's kind of where I see the biggest connection with like the disordering and the ordering of the soul, in that you're having this, you know, physical reaction to what you're listening to. And I know for myself, you know, I'll put the radio on in the car because my kids love certain ones of their songs. At some certain point, I'm like, we need to turn this off. My brain is falling apart. I can only listen to Raffi for so many hours before I lose my mind. And mom's losing her mind now, so we're turning it off. And, you know, I love Raffi. All great. But, you know, at a certain point, you're like, okay, I'm done. Which I don't get that feeling as much with classical music. I mean, there's times when I need silence because of something I'm doing, but I don't as much get the time of like, oh, my brain is just, it's like scrambled eggs right now. I need to turn it off. And so I think that we can kind of take a cue from the way our body reacts to the fact that, yes, you know, there is this disordering and ordering of the soul, and music is directly related to that and definitely affects that.
It makes me think of, at least I don't know if this is factually correct. I'm sure Mrs. Knuff, you can tell me whether this is right, but Ravel's Bolero, which is a piece that just builds and builds and builds, and then it drops. And as you're talking, as you're saying that, like the music has an effect on your soul, it brings about this thing. That's one of the parts of order that always kind of stood out to me. I kind of liked it when I was first, you know, and I guess there was rioting. I heard it at one of his first performances of this, because, you know, it's building up that energy, that passion, and then it just like leaves you. It's where typically your piece is kind of bringing about something and then resolving it. So there's a rise and a fall to it. Whereas this, and of course, you know, in a lot of modern music, you've got the either like, there was always the funny endings to like rock songs, I guess, where it's like, yeah, kind of at the end, or it fades away, you know, just kind of fades out while you keep repeating the same line. I mean, that's not always a sign of a good piece of music there, even for rock music, but that sort of thing where it's just like, okay, it's resonating with you, but affecting your soul. And then it just leaves you at that, wherever it is, without saying, okay, now let's come down or let's resolve the sorrow or whatever it is that, you know, so it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I touched on this earlier, but towards the end of our music history class, we were verging into the late Romantic, early modern. And we had been talking about the musical terms dissonance and consonance and what that means with regards to music. And you know, some of the later composers there was more dissonance in their music, you know, such as Stravinsky or, you know, other later composers. And wow, I had never, maybe it was one because the students were more comfortable in my class because it was towards the end of the semester. But I mean, I put on Stravinsky and so many, oh, this is terrible. Oh, I hate, oh no, 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 no. I don't like this at all. I mean, a good 80% of them probably said that. And I said, why do you not like it? And they're like, it's all over the place. It's not pretty, you know? And I said, are you hearing more of that dissonance? And all of a sudden they're like, oh yeah. Like, are you hearing that where you're kind of like two forces fighting against each other and it doesn't resolve where you want it to go? And they're all like, yeah, yeah. And it was just funny because what you were saying, Mr. Hayden, it's like, they just naturally had this reaction against these sounds that they didn't like the way they sounded together. And oh no, that's not as pretty. That's not as nice. We really are inclined to those, musical cadences that, that leave us where we want to be left and don't leave us hanging in this unknown place.
Yeah. There's this, I remember hearing about the, well, I'm hearing this in Tristan and Isolde. Is that Wagner? I forget.
Yes.
But there's this famous chord where, like, in the story, I guess there's this moment of kind of despair, and like he hits this chord and you hear it and it's like, yeah, there's no coming back from that. So, I mean, I can see, like, there, maybe I don't want to encounter that, maybe I don't want to be moved in that way. But it's reflect. I mean, it hits it. It reflects that despair, sort of like nothing I've ever heard. So, maybe you don't always want to go to those places, that the music is taking you to.
Right. It's interesting because one of the questions I asked the students, towards the end, we were like kind of reflecting on the semester, as I said, well, basically, you go from one era to the next and they're just basically breaking the rules of the era previously or reacting, like, Baroque, it became way too, way too many intricate harmonies and melodies. We want a simple line now in the classical. We want to know where the melody is. And then, you react to that and things become basically just constantly swinging back and forth and, breaking the rules and introducing new, musical concepts and things like that. And I said, well, are you happy that composers did do that, that they pushed the boundaries and kept evolving and changing? And, all of them said, yes, I'm so happy that they did, because music wouldn't have evolved the way it did. I'm glad we had the Romantic era and we didn't only stay in the Baroque era, and we evolved and we had these different sounds, different pieces written in this different way. And I said, okay, well, nowadays in contemporary music and in modern era music, they're just pushing the boundaries farther. So are we still okay with that, or we think they've crossed? Is there a line that you cross when it becomes no longer music? And that was really interesting to think about, because where does it become not music anymore to you, or according to you, or at least it leaves the genre of classical music? And how far can we bend these rules within the framework of classical music? And that was really interesting to discuss with them and to see what people said in response to it. I think it's something that we continue to think about, musicians continue to think about all the time, with the rise of, contemporary music, contemporary classical music, and things that are being pushed here, like composers like Philip Glass and other contemporary composers that are really pushing the boundaries on what we would think of as classical music.
It's funny that you mentioned Bolero, because recently I had the opportunity to go to a concert, and an orchestral concert. And I was like, I would go, because it was Debussy and some other 20th century work. I forget what it is now, but it would enjoy that. But it also featured Bolero. And I was like, no, I'm out. I cannot do Bolero. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, they probably wouldn't like very much a Steve Reich concert either. No. If you know Steve Reich's music.
Yep.
Although I think it's very interesting stuff. I mean, it's extreme minimalist music, but I think it's very interesting how he weaves patterns, rhythmic patterns throughout. And that's essentially what that music is. It's just all rhythmic patterns. Yeah. And I wonder how the students would react to that. In your discussion of Bolero and where it brings you or doesn't bring you, I was thinking about that in light of that I was listening this morning to Elgar's Enigma Variations, which is a piece that I've always loved. Mm-hmm. And for me, it draws such powerful emotion. It's a piece that just draws powerful emotions. And I just wondered how the kids might respond to something like that.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, I know. And I was thinking about that, and I should, come to you, Dr. Hassler, for a list of pieces, because next year, I'd love to introduce even more to them. And, you know, Dr. Hassler and I are running the classical music club now too, which we encourage all the students to go join. It's getting off the ground. And Dr. Hassler always posts some good suggestions on there. And, you know, exposure to all these pieces, I think, is just so wonderful. And something like Elgar's Enigma Variations, I'm very partial to Elgar's Cello Concerto too, which is, I think, one of the best, in my opinion. But something you were saying about Bolero, oh, I was going to say, we played Bolero in my youth orchestra. And you think you don't like it listening to it. I remember we'd pull it out, our conductor would be pulling it out. You're like, okay, we got to rehearse Bolero. All of us, oh, no, no, my gosh, anything else. So it's no more fun to play than it is to listen to, I can assure you.
There was a funny reel that it passed my, you know, that I scrolled past recently. It was a one of the percussionists, the snare drum. Like, which measure am I on now? It's just, no. Yeah.
Some of the newer stuff. So when you said, is there a limit to how you break things? And I first went like atonal music. Yeah, that's not it for me. But we had a guest on the podcast who was a curator or at an art museum or works, mm-hmm. you know, at an art, works at an art museum. And she talked about some of the postmodern, like the really blank sort of stuff being some of her favorites, not because they were the most appealing to her, but because they kind of reflected this nihilistic sort of like, if there's no hope, you know, or whatever, then this is the reflection of that. Could there be art if there's no order, no God? And I can't remember who said it either, but there was a quotation that was saying there's two people who've really lived out that sort of anarchic nihilistic thing. And it was Nietzsche and the Marquis de Sade. And mm-hmm. those are the two who actually lived out the effects of that. So, I don't want to go to those areas, but I see to a certain extent that they're reflecting the reality of those views. I mean, if that's in your soul, so that's not a place I want to go, but I can see even there that there's some good in actually seeing this is actually pointing to the reality that people would like us to kind of go down, that they if they actually embrace it, that no order is reflective of that. But I'm not encouraging anybody to go listen to atonal music still, but
that's more of a mathematical exercise, I think. Like to find, like you're talking about the patterns and it seems like that becomes more of that than music to me. Anyhow, that's probably not going to stay in anyway.
Well, it is. It's very much mathematics. But then mathematics is part of the creation, right? So there can be something in that is of interest, I agree, there's a tendency for it to sound quite empty at the same time.
Yeah,
so that's interesting. But isn't it the case that a lot of times with music it's what you bring to it as much as what the composer is offering? I mean, is there not something to that as well, that you come to a piece of music at one moment and it does nothing for you? You come to that same piece of music later on down the road and all of a sudden it speaks volumes to you. And I can think of several different composers or artists or what have you that upon my initial hearing of them, I thought, wow, this is nothing's there for me. And then years later, it strikes me in an entirely different way. And correlatively, people that I heard for the first time thought, wow, this is really great. You know, 6 months later, I go, why did I ever think that was anything worth listening to?
Yeah.
You know, I've had that reaction, you know, over the span of, you know, my short life often. And it's just interesting to me how, where you happen to be at any particular time. And I always connect it to the things that I'm reading as well, the literature that I'm reading and how all that sort of comes to play in something that I'm listening to. And that affects how I think about that piece of music or that genre.
Music, like smell, it kind of links those things in a more fundamental way. So like when I hear a piece of music that I really loved at a particular time in my life and I hear it again, it's like I'm drawn back actually to that time. And you know, I can sometimes even all those things connected, like I can smell the autumn leaves and feel the cool air in Wisconsin at the time, and it's just all of that in one when I hear the music again.
I hear the Firebird Suite, and it takes me back to the very first time I saw Yes in concert back in the mid-70s. They played, before they came on stage, they played the entire Firebird. And I was enthralled. I'm listening to one of my favorite Stravinsky pieces. And then this rock band comes out and plays for another 2 hours, you know, their long progressive music and stuff. I always think of that.
Wow.
It's true. Also, I was thinking when you were talking about, you know, how music takes you back to certain places. At one point, a couple of years ago, I was working with a music therapist, and she worked particularly with memory care patients. So those suffering from dementia and Alzheimer's. So I went with her, and we performed at one of these, you know, memory care facilities. And it was just as a part of her program that she runs for the residents there. And I had a resident come up to me afterwards and say, I forget one of the pieces that we played. It was me on the cello and she was on the flute. And she said, oh, that's my mother played cello. And that was a piece that she would play for me. And then she really couldn't remember anything else. But that piece, she said, oh, you took me back to sitting in my kitchen and listening to my mom playing that. And besides that, her memory was, you know, pretty poor on other things, her long-term memory, but that piece, you know, really took her back to that moment. I just thought, wow, how powerful is that, that hearing this piece of music kind of gave her this moment of clarity in her mind and brought her back to that, you know, pivotal moment in her childhood, which was just so, just shows the power of music and how it does, you know, it can transport us to whenever, you know, we heard that piece for the first time, or, you know, whenever, if we saw it live, definitely that experience would come back to us.
This segue into a whole bunch of interesting discussion on the brain and where music is in the brain and all that kind of stuff, which is not within the scope of our conversation today, but it kind of, I find that interesting as well, how those intersect.
It's funny because, you know, there's this whole kind of side to music where people talk about, you know, how babies in the womb react to music. And I might have mentioned this before, but I was teaching a group of beginner cellists when I was pregnant with my youngest daughter. And, you know, your cello rests right up against your body. So she was right there next to my cello. And I played Twinkle Twinkle probably, it felt like 8,000 times as we were learning it as a group. And I promise to this day, Twinkle Twinkle is the song that will calm my daughter down like nothing else. I mean, we will sing it to her when she's fussy in the car, when she hates the car. And it's her go-to jam, because that was her jam back, you know, before her arrival in this world even. And every time I would start playing it, she would start moving inside of me. And so I was always saying, oh yeah, you know, she's dancing. That's her favorite song. And still it's her favorite song. So it's just, there's just so many paths with me that you can go down with music and the incredible power that it has, which actually just kind of, you know, further supports the point of, you know, it having this ability to order a disorder of soul. If you think about, you know, how it has such an effect on children, has such an effect on, you know, our memory, it has such an effect on, you know, health in general. Music therapy can be powerful tool when it comes to all different areas of health, from mental health to physical health. And you would think, well, then of course it has an effect on our soul. If all these things are true, how could it not, in a way?
I had a similar thing with my kids, where my wife and I, when she, when she was pregnant with our oldest. We were living in Germany, and we were watching the American The Office like over and over. And that theme song to The Office, I remember we watched it so much because it was the only thing we could stream or something like that. And then we took this long break. But after my daughter was born, she like we would play that song and it would like wake her up or it would calm her down if she was crying. It was like you could tell she recognized it from when she was in the womb. And then I was always amazed with my second daughter. I would sing them lullabies and stuff like as I'm holding them, calming them down as babies. And from a really early age, my wife would remember the age, but before she could talk, they would make her cry. She would like cry as I was singing, and cry not because it was somehow it was affecting her, making her feel sentimental. And I'm like, you're just a little, I mean, you don't even have teeth, and you're crying over the sound of this little song. And that's interesting. It was one child's reaction out of my five was to cry when she hears these songs. And my son, he would choke up, but he's a little tougher. He had the same thing, the same sensitivity, but he wouldn't let it out, but you could see tears in his eyes. And I always thought that was so amazing that as little babies, that would affect them just to hear these songs.
Yeah. And you know, from pretty young, you know, babies will try to dance, you know, in reaction to music. You know, my girls were really little when, you know, you'd put something on and they'd start flapping their arms. Like they just initially have this physical reaction to music. And I just think it's like the most remarkable thing in children to see, you know, to see how much they react. And it really is this like visceral thing, but it's not taught. It's just instinctual in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So in cultivating a love for classical music, do you find that these points of connection that you make with your people that you're hoping to share this with, that to point out how much it, even if you don't say it outright, how much it means to you or how much you enjoy it or whatever, just to be observable that it is so enjoyable to you, or kind of narrating aloud, like, that's really interesting. This theme is showing up in this voice now, or now we're back to those sorts of things. How do you all encourage folks to pass on this love of classical music or even embark upon it for someone who does not yet have it?
Well, at least for me, that as Mrs. Konopke was talking about her class and exposing different sorts of things, because you don't know what's going to really speak to the soul of that particular person. Like for me, the starting point is much, I mean, I'm sort of a melancholic person in general. So for me, hearing the Bach cello suites, which is still my favorites, but just would speak to me in that the one instrument, so it's simpler. There's a lot going on, but it's not an orchestra, you know, and just it would speak to that sort of melancholy in my soul and somehow, you know, touch that, I guess. But for me, a lot of the simpler things are where I had to start, like, so whether it's Gregorian chant or then moving on to polyphony, but it gets to be because I don't have the memory yet. And my memory isn't even great now, but especially starting out, that spoke to me. But some people, that might not be what speaks to them at all right away. It might be the complexity.
Yeah, for some, the epic, you know, Mahler symphonies are what, you know, just gets them every time. I had one student in my class who was, you know, definitely probably one of my more laid back students, that it wasn't, you know, in there all the time in the discussion. And then I put on Ride of the Valkyries. Oh my goodness. He was like, this is my, play it again, please play it again. And I was like, okay, well, we found your piece. This is yours. This is your entryway into classical music. So I guess if someone were to come to me and say, not my thing. Classical music, not my thing. I'd say, let me go to Dr. Hassler and let me make a CD for you from all the things he has. And I assure you, we will find something in there that you like. Just, you know, give us a chance to give you a full sampling of everything that technically falls in the realm of classical music, because it's going to be all over the place.
We can make that happen, I think.
Yeah. A new
I
CD coming to coming to streaming services near you soon.
Put out a playlist. Yeah.
Yeah.
Love it. Watch some Looney Tunes and point out some music happening there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, funny that you said that. I've got a meme. I don't know where it is, somewhere, that says, okay, where do people hear classical music? Opera, low on the scale. Radio, low on the scale. Symphony, little higher on the scale. Elevator, little higher on the scale. Looney Tunes, all the way to the top.
Yeah.
You know, I know that when I was growing up, that's where I heard a lot of classical music to begin with before I got into a band program. And then, you know, being in a band program, I got introduced to Wagner and Stravinsky and Bartok and Prokofiev, as well as the sort of more band-related kinds of pieces. But one of the things that I remember most that really always sort of intrigued me is when we would warm up, we played Bach chorales. And, you know, in warming up, you know, we would hold certain chords. That was always so beautiful because, I mean, Bach chords are always just really wonderful things. And that's always stuck in the back of my mind as well. So this breadth of music, you know, and all these different genres we've been talking about, if you're not exposed to any of this, you know, then for me, the first task is just to, you know, like a cafeteria here, try these little bites, you know, from all these different genres, classical, pop, contemporary, jazz. Listen to the stuff, see what moves you, because something will. And when it does, it will enrich your soul.
Yeah. Or, and also pick your, tell, let me know what your favorite movie is. Now watch it without the sound on. Is it still your favorite movie? We talked about that, you know, Wagner was the first one to introduce the idea of a theme song, like a motif, you know, like that idea. And of course, everybody thought right away, you know, of like, the big movies like Lord of the Rings or, you know, James Bond theme song, these theme songs that you know, even if you've never watched the movies, because it's like, oh, this is the theme song for that character, right? And we talked about in class, you know, imagine how silly a lot of these movies would look if you, you know, turned off the music. And so I guess I'd also challenge someone who said, oh, I don't really like Casa Nova. Well, try watching your favorite movie without the music on. And I bet you're going to miss it. And then that makes you do like classical music because it's playing a part in the movie that you say you love.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe,
I think it's...
maybe the name classical music is perhaps misleading.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I don't have a suggestion for anything else, but I mean, we talk about classical music and that, you know, already somebody's painting this picture in their mind about something that, you know, only old people listen to. And, you know, it's just this whatever. And they just have a misunderstanding that it's just music.
Yeah.
Right.
It's music from a certain period in history.
And it's the place where all other music has been derived from. So,
oh, absolutely.
You know, we talked about that a little bit, but you know, oh, you like jazz? Well, jazz came out of, you know, what we're calling classical music. Classical music was just music for the longest time, period, until kind of these offshoots started to
The
come
soundtrack
to be.
Of the time. Yeah.
Popular
yeah.
music came from the Lieder songs, and you know.
Yeah.
I just wonder sometimes if we're, you know, labeling things and the label itself is just misleading to them. And how do you get them out of their labeling?
Yeah, it's very oversimplified. I think it's well worth the effort to have conversations with our kids about the responses that we're feeling physically, emotionally, mentally to the music that we're listening to. And, you know, by extension, the things that we read or watch or, you know, however we're taking in whatever form of media. I think it's a good discussion worth having, and to get them to learn how to notice that response within themselves, that I think that will serve them well. Yeah. And as I was tossing this question out, Stephen, I was thinking about the times you described your Sunday mornings when you're playing polyphony on Sunday, and I thinking about the memories that are created, not explicitly, not like I want to remember this moment or whatever, but the takeaway that your family will have, your children in the coming years, of I had this beautiful Sunday mornings with my parents, my family, and this was the soundtrack, and it'll come up at some other point. They'll hear that music elsewhere, and it will take them back to that time with you and the connection they felt with you at that time. And it's just like the daily living, and this is the soundtrack, so that later when they come back, when it comes to them in some other form though, or context, it'll take them back to a happy place. I don't know. And I think that might also hopefully lead to an interest, at least, of exploring more in the various eras of classical music that we're, you know, that we kind of lump together in that term. I don't know.
Creating a soundtrack for our life, I guess. And hopefully my polyphony leads more to like preparation for mass in their mind than waffles and bacon, but both are good things, but one is better. So
I think there's a place, there's room for all of that together. Like it's all, yeah. Well, toward the end of fostering some exploration of this genre and the various eras of it, and developing a love for classical music, maybe for the whole family, we have a few resources to provide that might be some good jumping off points. We already mentioned our previous conversation on Music Movement One, as I'll refer to it, episode 186. I really enjoy Dr. Anthony Esselin's Word and Song Substack newsletter that he has. He and his wife work on it together. Dr. Esselin was on episode 28 of the Colby Cast way back in the day. But he and his wife work on the Substack together. The various days of the week, they'll cover different topics. So they'll cover a word that will continue, the theme will continue through the whole week, various musical pieces. Some of it is hymnody, which I find very interesting as a church musician. He'll also mention, they will also bring up vintage music and movies. I've got a lot of movie recommendations there. And so I really enjoy that very much. There are also some hymn suggestions for families working through the Faith and Life religion series that Colby uses for the elementary and middle school religion courses. There are hymn suggestions in the teacher manuals. And as a church musician myself, I'm embarrassed to say I didn't make more use of that resource when I was working through those courses with my kids. I wish I had. And I wish I would have given more time to playing the hymns as part of the coursework I was doing with them throughout the week. I think I probably figured at the time, well, they hear that a lot with me being a church musician. So I wish I had been more deliberate about that. So those are there. The Colby Bookstore publishes a Laudate listening guide written by Dr. Robert Spencer. Lots of recommendations there broken down by age and also genre. So we'll provide a link to that in our show notes. Couple more to mention. I'm going on and on here. We had Mike Aquilina on the Colby Cast, episode 191. He has some writings on music that are very interesting. I'm still working on his How the Choir Converted the World. I'm still working on that. That's one example of many. And then from episode 35 with Professor Carol Reynolds. Do you like how I'm speeding up faster and faster with my talking? This is the third cup of coffee kicking in now. So episode 35 of the Colby Cast with Professor Carol Reynolds, who wrote the music history course that we discussed in our previous episode. Her husband, Dr. Hank Reynolds, also an accomplished musician, publishes Friday Performance Picks, where he curates some performances and recordings similar to Dr. Hassler. So if you put those two together, you'll have quite a rich pool to draw from to start off. Well, what should we listen to, or what's going on here? And so those are all great. So you all have survived my lengthy recommendations. So it's been really great visiting with you guys again for this second movement. I have some thoughts for our third movement, but I would love to hear yours as well. Dr. Hassler and Mrs. Konefke, thank you so much for coming to visit with us. We really appreciate it and look forward to next time.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
Subscribe to the Colby Cast on your favorite podcast app so that you don't miss an episode. And let us know how we're doing by leaving a rating or a review. And as always, feel free to email us at podcast@colby.org.
Mary, our Mother, pray for us. St. Maximilian Colby, St. Ignatius of Loyola, Holy Saints and Angels, pray for us. Ad Maiorem Dei Gloriam.